translation. By those riches, the king could procure the ingredients for 3 horse sacrifices. Thus, the pious king Yudhisthira, who was very fearful after the battle of Kurukshetra, pleased Lord Hari, the personality of Godhead. So, now, I'm fortunate in a sense because, well, we're all fortunate in the sense that Prabhupada here has written quite a substantial purport. So, I'll go through it. Very good. There's lots of information in here. So we won't have any lack of information and things to learn today, hopefully. Let's see what Prabhupada writes. Maharaj Yudhisthira was the ideal and celebrated pious king of the world. And still he was greatly afraid after the execution of the Battle of Kurukshetra because of the mass killing in the fight, of which all of which was done only to install him on the throne. He therefore took all the responsibility for sins committed in the warfare, and to get rid of all those sins, he wanted to perform 3 sacrifices in which horses are offered at the altar. Such a sacrifice is very costly. Even Maharaj Yudhisthira had to collect the necessary heaps of gold left by Maharaj Maruta and the Brahmanas who were given gold in charity by King Maruta. The learned Brahmanas could not take away all the loads of gold given by Maharaj Maruta, and therefore they left behind the major portion of the gift. And Maharaj Maruta also did not again collect such heaps of gold given away in charity. Besides that, all the golden plates and utensils which were used in the sacrifice were also thrown in the dustbins, and all such heaps of gold remained unclaimed property for a long time, till Maharaj Yudhisthira collected them for his own purposes. Lord Sri Krishna advised the brothers of Maharaj Yudhisthira to collect the unclaimed property because it belonged to the king. The more astonishing thing is that no subject of the state also collected such unclaimed gold for industrial enterprise or anything like that. This means that the state citizens were completely satisfied with all necessities of life and therefore not inclined to accept unnecessary productive enterprises for sense gratification. Maharaj Yudhisthira also requisitioned the heaps of gold for performing sacrifices and for pleasing the Supreme, Hari, the personality of Godhead. Otherwise, he had no desire to collect them for the state treasury. One should take lessons from the acts of Maharaj Yudhisthira. He was afraid of sins committed on the battlefield, and therefore he wanted to satisfy the supreme authority. This indicates that unintentional sins are also committed in our daily occupational discharge of duties. And to counteract even such unintentional crimes, one must perform sacrifices as they are recommended in the revealed scriptures. The Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita, Yagyatat karamano natra loko yam kama bandhanaha, that one must perform sacrifices recommended in the scriptures in order to get rid of comments of all unauthorized work, or even unintentional crimes which are apt to commit. By doing so, one shall be freed from all kinds of sins, and those who do not do so, but work for self-interest or sense gratification, have to undergo all tribulations accrued from sinful committed sins. Therefore, the main purpose of performing sacrifices is to satisfy the Supreme Personality, Hari. The process of performing sacrifices may be different in different times, places, and persons, but the aim of such sacrifices is one and the same at all times and in all circumstances, viz. Satisfaction of the Supreme Lord Hari. That is the way of pious life and is the way of peace and prosperity in the world at large. Maharaj Yudhisthira did all those things as the ideal pious king of the world. If Maharaj Yudhisthira is a sinner in his daily discharge of duties in royal administration and of state affairs, wherein killing of man and animals is a recognized art, then we shall just imagine the amount of sins committed consciously or unconsciously by untrained population of the Kali Yuga who have no way to perform sacrifice to please the Supreme Lord. The Bhagavatam says, therefore, that the prime duty of the human being is to satisfy the Supreme Lord by the performance of one's occupational duty. Bhagavatam 1.2.13. Let any man of any place or community, caste or creed be engaged in any sort of occupational duty, but he must agree to perform sacrifices as it is recommended in the scriptures for the particular place, time and person. In the Vedic literatures, it is recommended that in the Kali Yuga, people engaged in glorifying the Lord by chanting the holy name of Krishna, Kirtana Deva Krishnasya Mukta Sangha Padam Vajet, without offence. By doing so, one can be freed from all sins and thus can attain the highest perfection of life by returning back home, back to Godhead. We have already discussed this more than once in this great literature in different places, especially in the introductory portion by the Sketching the Life of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and we are still repeating the same with a view to bring about peace and prosperity in society. The Lord had declared openly in Bhagavad Gita how he becomes pleased with us, and the same process is practically demonstrated in the life and preaching work of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The perfect process performing yagyas or sacrifice to please the Supreme Lord Hari, the personality of Godhead, who gets us free from all miseries of existence, is to follow the ways of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in this dark age of quarrel and dissension. Maharaj Yudhisthira had to collect heaps of gold to secure the paraphernalia for the horse sacrifice yagyas in days of sufficiency. So we can hardly think of such performances of yagyas in these days of insufficiency and complete scarcity of gold. At the present moment, we have heaps of papers and promises of their being converted into gold by economic development of modern civilization, and still there is no possibility of spending riches like Maharaj Yudhisthira, either individually or collectively or by state patronization. Such just suitable, therefore, for the age is the method recommended by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in terms of the Shastra. Such a method requires no expenditure at all, and yet can award more benefit than other expensive methods of yagya performances. The horse sacrifice yagya or cow sacrifice yagya performed by the Vedic regulations shouldn't be misunderstood as the process of killing animals. On the contrary, animals offered for the yagya were rejuvenated to a new span of life by the transcendental power of chanting the Vedic hymns, which, if properly chanted, are different from that which is understood by the common layman. The Vedic mantras are all practical, and the proof is rejuvenation of the sacrificed animal. There is no possibility of such a methodological chanting of the Vedic hymns by the so-called brahmanas or priests of the present age. The untrained descendants of the twice-born families are no more like their forefathers, and thus they are counted amongst the shudras or once-born men. The once-born man is unfit to chant the Vedic hymns, and therefore there is no practical utility of chanting the original hymns. And to save them all, Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu propounded the Sankirtan movement or yagya for all practical purposes, and the people of the present age are strongly recommended to follow this sure and recognized path. The original verse again. By those riches, the king would procure the ingredients for the three horse sacrifices. Thus, the pious King Yudhisthira, who was very fearful after the battle of Kurukshetra, pleased Lord Hari, the personality of Godhead. Om Akhyanam Tadidam Dashantalangara Shalakaya Takso Om Manisam Yenaha Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobistam Sapitam Yenabhutale Svayam Rupa Gadam Mayam Tadati Svaparantikam He Krishna Kuruna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namushtite Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vaspasaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gurvani Vacharine Nivasesha Shunyavadi Vrashachade Satadine Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. After I read that purport by Prabhupada, a very elaborative purport actually, I thought to myself, where do I begin? Because in one sense, it's a class in itself. And in many ways, I feel unworthy to actually follow that, because in one sense, Prabhupada, well, in many senses, Prabhupada has said everything there. So I'll humbly attempt to perhaps add some more detail, or to perhaps have some discuss some related matters, relating, of course, to the purport. So the Bhagavatam 1.2.13 that is quoted was about occupational duty, in this case, of a king or whoever is relevant. And this is all about the ancient duties of Kshatriyas, like, of course, Maharaj Yudhisthira. So that verse reads, O best among the twice-born, it is therefore concluded that the highest perfection one can achieve by discharging the duties prescribed for one's own occupation, according to caste divisions and orders of life, is to please the personality of Godhead. Of course, when it talks about caste, or indeed, of course, Varna and Ashram, it's talking about how they were much more sufficiently and much more appropriately followed before the age of Kali. Prabhupada himself writes in the second half of his purport that in the age of Kali, things are a little different because of the lack of qualification of the inhabitants, us, to actually follow these proper sacrifices and so forth. At the same time, what is still relevant for all the yugas is the basic principle that whatever varna or whatever ashram we find ourselves in, there's a certain amount of duty that is required for that. Just for example, the duties of man, the duties of a woman, the duties of a Brahmin, the duties of a Kshatriya, the duties of a Brahmachari, the duties of a Grihastha. So these are even existent in the age of Kali. But a lot of the things recommended, I think, for different ages, different processes to please Lord Vishnu have changed. We all know what the age of Kali process is, given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with the chanting of Hare Krishna. We know this. This is well known to all devotees. But of course, in previous ages, the process was somewhat different, which was impossible for us today. So we got like a little get-out clause, in a sense. But in the second half of Prabhupada's purport, he also makes it very clear to the reader that horse sacrifice isn't, I suppose, what we imagine it to be. Obviously, in one sense, it conjures fairly unpleasant images in our mind, but this needs clarification. The true context of the Ashwamedha, the horse sacrifice, this, of course, was performed by ancient kings like Maharaj Maruta and other kings that Yudhisthira obviously looked up to, especially in the Sun dynasty, actually, was the fact that this resulted in months, if not years, of mantras that were recited before the horse was involved. But the horse would be released, or several horses, depending on the kingdom that the emperor was claiming, would be let loose, usually a male horse, and decorated as such so it would be recognized as the Ashwamedha horse. And any king that wanted to challenge the emperor of the time would basically pinch the horse. In fact, Indra did that a few times with Maharaj Prithu, but we'll get into that later. So in other words, they would take the horse into his own kingdom, and that would be a challenge to the emperor, saying, okay, I don't accept you. I'm not going to accept your sacrifice. I'm not going to attend your Rajasura sacrifice. I don't think that you're the king of the world. So in that, of course, no one touched Yudhisthira's horses. But that was the process. It was a culture of the time that was particularly followed, actually, in the Treta Yuga. But it was understood, of course, that this also involved, like as I said before, a large role, in fact, a central role of the brahmanas, and of course the giving away of tons and tons of gold in charity. Most of that gold, of course, where is it all today? It's been lost. It's understood that the earth, Mother Earth, has taken the gold back. So there's less gold available to us today, more than in Yudhisthira's time. The amount of gold they would use would be more than that was in Fort Knox, even. So, and they did this many, many times. It was a huge amount of gold, so much so, as Prabhupada describes, that it was sometimes left at the side of the road or left in dustbins. For two reasons. One, gold was plentiful. Two, the society was very respectful of the king's property and the Brahmana's property. You know, it's like, you do not touch. It's like, you don't take money off the offering plate. You know, there's a culture there. And also the people were happy, relatively happy with the king. So they had a great respect and culture. They let the gold, well, that's the king's gold, you don't touch that, even if it's lying in a ditch or something. There was no need, because obviously society as a whole was more spiritual, I would say, than it is today. But the Ashwamedha was done specifically as a purpose of atonement, and of course this is why Yudhisthira chose to do this. It was removing; it used to remove the sinful reactions of the king, but also the ruling household in general. A relief, even by killing a Brahmin, in fact. Like Bhagavatam 6:13, 8, and 9 reads, "Herein the sages encourage King Indra to kill Vitasura, even at the risk of Brahman Hatya, or the killing of a Brahmin, and they guarantee to release him from the sinful reactions by performing the Ashwamedha Yajna." But next verse reads, "Indra could not be relieved from the reaction of simply in performing sacrifices for atonement for killing a Brahmana. He also had to undergo a series of sinful reactions for which he was freed by suffering. The Brahmanas allowed him to perform the horse sacrifice, but on top of that, he had to perform austerities as well." So throughout the late Vedic culture, it appears that the process, the Ashwamedha sacrifice, was recognized as a process of atonement, but it was never on its own. There was also the gold, or the charity, or the mantras, or the atonement. You know, there was the austerities of the king, in this case Indra, where he would be fasting and performing austerities and so forth. The horse bit was simply there because obviously the horse would indeed be offered in the fire, but then as a sign from Lord Vishnu himself that everything had been done correctly, the mantras are done correctly, then a young calf would appear at the other side of the fire in the same instant. So it was a miracle, and it was a sense, it was giving an old horse a new body. So this idea, this conception of animal sacrifice that we sometimes, that still goes on in places today, in some traditions today, and certainly just before the beginning of, during the time of Lord Buddha, actually. This is actually a misunderstanding. The mass slaughter of animals was not supported in the Vedas. But as the Kali Yuga ensued, this was misunderstood by basically unqualified Brahmanas, as Prabhupada brings attention to. Of course, it's completely forbidden in the Kali Yuga, but not so forbidden in former Yugas, as mentioned. But in each Yuga, there's different methods, as I mentioned, and I'll quickly read those out. I think we know in the Satya Yuga, where the time of goodness, where human beings were practically direct descendants or indirect descendants of great demigods or great personalities, of course, like Vaishvata Manu and Ikshvaku Manu from the beginning of the Satya Yuga. And then, you know, they were living for hundreds of thousands of years, well, up to about 100,000 years. And their process was meditation on the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu in the heart, concentrating on the Paramatma. And they would do this they were able to do this for thousands of years. So, of course, this is out. We can't do that today. We can't even live for that long. What to speak of meditating in caves or at the top of the Himalayas or underwater sometimes. So powerful were the yogis of that period, we can barely imagine. We're more or less like chimpanzees in comparison, actually. Talk about devolution, you know. But as time went by, as the Satya Yuga came and went, the Treta Yuga came, and things kind of start to a little bit less pure, you know, lost about 25% of its potency, in a sense, it's described. So the process had to be different for self-realization. These austerities, as mentioned, was no longer as appropriate. Treta Yuga was a time where we know there was the beginning of urbanization. Suddenly, during that time, Ayurvedic medicine was introduced because people started to get ill. But Varna and Ashram was introduced as well in the Treta Yuga. It didn't actually exist in the Satya because it didn't need to exist. There was no urbanized society. We know that in the Treta Yuga, of course, that there's the great kings and so forth, but, and the Vana and Ashram as described was developed, just like, for example, in the time of Lord Ram, which was at the beginning of the Treta Yuga. But still, very potent human beings, when compared to ourselves, would live up to about 10,000 years. And it was in the Treta Yuga that these great sacrifices were recommended. Because at that time, there was great, the various kings had great, great wealth. Therefore, the giving of gold and the chanting of the mantras was practical and quite, well, relative for them, relatively easy, I suppose, or doable at least. As a Dwapara Yuga came by, again, another 25% was lost. And this time people would be, well, you know, they'd be considered lucky if they lived to 1,000 years, but still 10 times longer than anyone here, anyone in the Kali Yuga. At this time, for most Maharajas, of course, the sacrifices was again becoming impractical, and the process of deity worship in temples became the process of realization. And of course, the kings would be ruling, were less and less powerful, I suppose, than their predecessors. But of course, in the age of Kali, we know, of course, it was the gain. Of course, someone might say, well, okay, so Yudhisthira was living in the Dwapara Yuga, but he was actually, the horse sacrifices were actually recommended in the Treta Yuga. So why was that? But because it was the after the Kurukshetra, as we know, it was such a big battle. I mean, we're talking about at least 18 Akshahini divisions, I believe. It's about 11 on the side of Duryodhan and the Kauravas, and on the other side, the remaining 7 Akshahinis, of course, was on the side of the Pandavas. So, you know, there was a lot on each side, although it was in the favour of Duryodhan, actually, in terms of numbers. But that's a lot. That's a lot. And millions of foot soldiers, charioteers, kings, even charioteers, or even those that, you know, got caught up in the battle, backup, you know, and warriors were killed in that battle. And Yudhisthira had a conscience. In fact, he had more of a conscience than probably anyone else on that battlefield. He never told a lie. He didn't even want to tell a lie when it came to, I think it was Ashwatthama, the elephant. He didn't want to actually say that he'd died when he hadn't. So the Krishna's trick was, I'll blow the conch at the same time when you say the elephant bit. So, so-and-so, Ashwatthama, then boop, the elephant is dead. So he tricked, but Yudhisthira had such a conscience. It was a white lie in a sense, but it was deliberately, how would you say, giving the wrong idea. Although technically speaking, Yudhisthira didn't lie because the conch was conveniently blown. But it was a setup. Let's face it, it was a setup. And there were a lot of these things that happened in the back of Kurukshetra. There was not the fault of Yudhisthira, but on the fault of Duryodhan, when he realized he wasn't actually going to win very easily. All the rules and all the regulations of Vedic battle started to go literally out of the window. You imagine there was, even at night time, sometimes the great kings would meet each other, shake hands, share maybe a glass of wine together or whatever they were doing. So, oh, you performed particularly well today, didn't you? Yes, well, you know, it was actually on that level. This actually happened between Duryodhana, Arjuna and Bhishma. They're actually having, even praising each other for their prowess. In real kshatriyas, actually. But the next morning, you know, when the sun rose, it was back to the battle. It was back to the hard work, you know. But all those rules and those etiquettes, like not fighting at night time all these rules, the idea that if you're on a chariot, you attack someone else on a chariot, you don't go for a foot soldier. A foot soldier would fight another foot soldier. A king would generally fight another king. It wasn't a free-for-all. There were, according to the rules and regulations of battle, they followed them. But as a sheer sign that Kali Yuga was on its way, in the latter half of the battle of Kurukshetra, it all started, well, to break down. And Yudhisthira, although Yudhisthira himself, of course, being a noble and righteous ruler, he felt something for that. He had a very strong conscience. He thought, they did all that for me? Or this battle, millions have died just so I could be on the throne. And yet I've lost so many people. in the process. You know, so many people have died, even on the Pandava side. Okay, the Pandavas, five Pandavas survived, but many friends and well-wishers had perished, including Arjuna's son. So war, even for the victors of war, war is not a fun thing. You know, war is not a good thing. And the battle of Kurukshetra, we must understand that it was the absolute last resort. Yudhisthira, of course, was constantly trained to Arjuna and Bhima in particular. Calm down, let's not fight. We'll just live simply in the forest. And Bhima and Arjuna were constantly saying, come on, let's go to Duryodhana and knock him off, especially Bhima. He was, especially during the game of dice, where they lost the Pandavas lost the kingdom. Bhima could have, if he was given permission by Yudhisthira, he would have gone for it straight away. But Yudhisthira was so much in control of, you know, he was so detached, so dharmic actually, that he said, no, the time is not right, the time is not right. But unfortunately, it was a war that had to happen. But it wasn't a war that Yudhisthira wanted to happen. And so therefore he felt, well, he looked to his ancestors, his great, those that preceded him by many thousands of years, like Marj Prithu, Marj Nabi, and Marj Maruta, who had done great austerities of their own, as well as sacrifices, especially Prithu, actually, and said, this is what I want to do. This is how the king receives atonement. And so therefore, the Ashwamedha sacrifices were performed. Of course, we understand that if we, as I mentioned before, we're dealing with, a lot of the Mahabharat is dealing with the second section, or the latter section of the Dwapara Yuga, the former Yuga. And of course, it brings us into the Kali Yuga. And this chapter, many verses in this chapter is about the birth and the praising of the birth of Maharaj Prichit, of course, who followed as emperor of the world after Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira was detached enough and of course, retired into the mountains with the other Pandavas. Their deed was done, and it was all left really to Maharaj Prichit on the throne. But we know that he, of course, was killed by the snake bird Takshaka, due to the curse of the Brahman Sringi. So again, the relationship between Brahmanas and Kshatriyas began to break down as the symptoms of the Kali Yuga began. In fact, Yudhisthira would look out sometimes and hear the howling wolves, or look at the stars and observe the weather and see that all the omens were there in place for the Kali Yuga. And when Krishna himself left the earth, he felt it was time to go. But amazing, isn't it, how the king with such opulence as Yudhisthira or many of his predecessors, ultimately they were not, or should have not have been, as Vedic kings, as true kings. Ultimately they had to renounce the palace and the wealth and live in austerity. And you imagine the Pandavas, after all they'd been through, 14 years in exile and the great battle of Kurukshetra and so forth, and all their leelas that are described in the Mahabharata. In the end, they just walked into the Himalayas, into the mountains, in the snow, until one by one they all passed on. So even they, those great austerities performed. So, even in the Treta Yuga and Dwapara Yugas, the idea of the Ashwamedha sacrifices alone, without the austerities of the king, lacked in completion. So it's very important. Janmijaya took over after, of course, Maharaj Prichit, and he had a thing. He had a grudge, of course, against snakes, because that's how his father was killed, by the snake bird. So he had a great sacrifice, where he was offering any snakes, basically, they could find in the kingdom, and also in the lower regions as well. There was mantras that were actually, they weren't just going up and picking snakes up from the forest and saying, right, in you go, you know, in a basket, you know, just something like out of a David Attenborough, you know, documentary or something. They were chanting mantras which summoned the snakes into the fire, and this even I think even attracted Vishuki as well, who actually in the end had to say, stop, enough snakes have been killed, they have their role in nature, actually stop this sacrifice. But, you know, that after Janmijay was still a very powerful Dharmic king, actually. After him was Sunika. But after that, we find that the kingdom of Bharat started to break up, ultimately. The different provinces, the different parts of the world started to gradually break away from, despite, of course, the efforts of the great kings, other kingdoms started to break away from the authority of the Vedic emperor. Thus, Kali Yuga and the symptoms of were revealed. Even if we look at a very good example I mentioned before is the fact that even in India itself, even in Bharat itself, there was corruption and misunderstanding, and therefore Buddha had to come, of course, to teach and was taking his followers actually away from the Vedas, which doesn't appear particularly auspicious. But given that the Vedas were used by the Brahmin caste to kill so many innocent animals, there was a need to teach ahimsa of the time. Because in the Kali Yuga, everything is wrong. The kings are not kings. The queens are not queens. The brahmanas are not proper brahmanas. The sudras, are not sudras. Everything is mixed round. And that is the breakdown of varna and ashram and the duties of each is what has created, in many senses, the Kali Yuga. No one knows what to do. No one really understands or wants to follow their duty or knows what their duty is. And that is the problem. And from a spiritual point of view, it is the breakdown of society. A good example is, yes, there are empires in the Kali Yuga, whether it's the Egyptians, or the Greeks, or the Romans, or the European empires, or the Genghis Khan empire, all these different empires. But actually, in comparison with Maharaja Yudhisthira, they were all rascals, really. All rascals. For example, the Roman Empire, of course, the first, which represented the urbanization or the so-called modernization, you say, of Western Europe in a sense. Architecturally, in terms of building aqueducts, or even had central heating or reservoirs and so on and so forth, they were quite advanced in a material way. But basically, it was one Caesar, one emperor after another, killing each other, more or less. Each emperor basically had to look behind their shoulder in case someone was going to stab them. And you find this even in all kingdoms across the world. The successions of kings, was lost because it was replaced by someone who was unqualified. And in terms of the Roman Empire, successive emperors claiming divinity and not listening to the Senate, I suppose, which represented what was left of the Brahmin caste, in a sense. But, they weren't much better themselves. It was just a strive for greed and power. But in one sense, today, although superficially it may not be quite as gritty as the gladiators, it's roughly the same type of thing in a more subtle way we have today. In comparison with Maharaja Yudhisthira, leaders of today, we're just the same rascals. We're still living in a society which is dependent on, imports and exports. We've lost touch with Mother Earth. We've over-urbanized, over-materialized, and built ourselves into a situation where spirituality and the original role and point of the brahmanas and the kings is almost invisible, or it seems to be... people are not able to perceive or understand anything anymore. And people say, religion in the past, it caused so much war, so what's the point? But of course, when people make bona fide claims, actually, in that sense, because these are valid points, but nevertheless, they're only talking about in the Kali Yuga and how religion has been misunderstood or misrepresented many, many times for political gain. Again, a Kali Yuga symptom. But finally, Prabhupada, just before I finish, Prabhupada mentions a quite interesting point, and again a reference to modern society, where in former times, the currency was gold. It was real gold. That was the currency. And then as time went by, particularly in the Kali Yuga, it became maybe gold sovereigns or became bits of metal or whatever it may have been. And then, of course, it became paper, which is something we still use today. Bits of paper saying, if you pick up an old note, it would say, I promise to pay the bearer of £10 or something. There's a picture of the Queen or whatever, somebody's on there. But it's actually just a piece of paper, really, with a line through it. And yet, that has replaced gold. And it says, I promise to pay. So it's actually an IOU. It's not real currency. And today, what's replacing paper money is digital money. You know, figures on an ATM or, figures on a computer screen. It doesn't even exist. Money doesn't actually exist as we understand it. And so therefore, the whole world is indebted to itself because it's based on a falsehood, actually. It's based on a falsehood. Whereas in times of Mara Yudhisthira and before, it was based on a real economy, real agriculture, and real varna and ashram. So I'll finish there. It's 8:30 on the dot. Does anyone have anything to add or any comments or questions?